This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. To start us off today, let me list a few names. Elvis Presley, The Beatles, U2, Gwen Stefani, and E.O. Wilson. Why these names? Well, they've all been called rock stars. And even though you may not know all their names, you certainly know some of them. My guest today is one of the rock stars in the world of science. Edward O. Wilson, or for those that follow rock stars of science as well as they follow rock stars of music, he's known as simply E.O. Wilson. If you haven't heard of him, try typing in Edward O. Wilson into the search engine Google. You'll end up with millions of results. So just who is E.O. Wilson? Well, he's a biologist, author, and an artist who's been observing life on our planet with a particular interest in ants. But his interests extend far beyond these six-legged insects to include all living things. In fact, he's one of the main persons behind the Encyclopedia of Life web project, as well as a very interesting activity called BioBlitzes. Today we get a chance to talk about the Encyclopedia of Life, BioBlitzes, his scientific work, and his art. Welcome to Ask a Biologist, Professor Wilson.
I'm delighted to be here, Dr. Biology.
Would you mind if I call you Ed?
I prefer it. When I was a kid, I was known variously as Bugs or Snake Wilson. I just mentioned that because to tell you, that I started my interest in outdoors pretty young.
You did, and actually we get to talk about that a little bit later because I think it's fascinating to know how a lot of the scientists do start young, and you had a really interesting find, I would say, at a young age. We'll talk about that. But before we get into that, let me start by giving you a test, something different. Biodiversity is a word that is being used a lot. Well, it's being used a lot these days. We often hear it in the classroom as well as in the media. You might read it in a local newspaper. In 2 minutes or less, can you explain what biodiversity is and why it's important?
I better be able to. I introduce the word. Biodiversity is short for biological diversity. And it means all the different species and all the different ecosystems, habitats a species live in. And it just means the totality, the whole life on Earth, but studied from the point of view of variation, variety among different life forms, different kinds of snakes, different kinds of plants, and so on.
And so why is it so important?
It's so important because our lives depend on it.
So you mean to tell me that if we lose, a few hundred plants, it could be a problem?
Big problem, especially if they include the plants that we get all our food from. But even if they didn't, you have all sorts of things go wrong. You need a lot of different kinds of plants to collect the water up on the mountainsides and let it trickle down slowly so we just don't get washed out every time. You need plants that support animal life of all sorts. You need plants of a great variety to give you enough oxygen in the air to breathe, and so on. And the same is true of different kinds of animals that we need. And some of those animals, incidentally, are very small. You never see them. And they're there in huge numbers in the soil, the dirt in your feet, and up in the trees and so on. And most people don't even know they're there. But it turns out that we need them up there and down there doing all the things that lead to circulating the materials, the nutrients, the things the soil consists of, and generally keeping the whole system we live on working. And we need all of them. We can't start just letting too many of them get extinct or throw them away.
All right. Well, now that we have a basic understanding of biodiversity, let's shift to an activity that you were one of the pioneers of. It's called a BioBlitz. And if a person didn't know any better, they might think it's something to do with football or some other sport. So what is a BioBlitz?
A BioBlitz is a great big celebration. It's a great big treasure hunt. And to have a Bible that you get a lot of people together, some time of the day, you could start in the afternoon or start in the morning, who are interested in finding different kinds of plants and animals out in nature, like a treasure hunt. And they all gather together, and they're experts. And then they're just anybody, families and others who want to come along and be part of it. And the idea is to see how many different kinds of plants and animals you can find in a 24-hour period.
Oh, so it's got a time limit.
Yes, it does. And actually, you can even have contests, you know, different towns having different biolists and competing. And it's the idea then is to see how high you can get the score. And you don't have to verify that you did see this and you saw that. And you can easily get, in a 24-hour period, if you have enough folks working, like over 1,000 different kinds. And, you know, it's so interesting because not only do you see people having a lot of fun, they're turning up rare species that experts say, we haven't seen one of these in 20 years around here. Or, it happens all the time, new species. The expert may be an expert on butterflies or an expert on dragonflies or something like that. Says, my heavens, that's a new species. And let's get a specimen of that, and we'll get it in there, and we'll get the scientific name put on it because we need to know about that in the future.
I just think that's so cool that you could go out and explore, and you might, during this treasure hunt, discover something for the very first time. And from an earlier show, we got to talk to Quentin Wheeler, who runs the International Institute for Species Exploration. And it's easy to find. It's called species.asu.edu. And one of the things he mentioned is not only do you get to discover them, you get to name them. Can you talk about some of the names you have put on some of the ants that you've discovered?
Yes. Well, usually it's the scientists that you get them to, you know, who knows all the different kinds and knows that it's a new species that names it. But he can name it after you. And I named a lot of species of ants after the people who found them.
Okay. Well, you know, now I'm motivated. I need to go out and do this. Which brings me to the point of, can you do a BioBlitz in your backyard?
You can, yes. It'd be kind of tough on your backyard if you had 100 people showing up to just do a BioBlitz in your backyard. But you could do it with two or three people, and you'll be amazed at what you can find in a backyard. Even if you have a sort of a scrubby little backyard without a lot of plants in it, pretty soon you'll probably be getting dozens of different kinds of insects. And if you got a magnifying glass and you start looking at the soil, you know, the dirt down there, pretty soon you'll see other things there. But generally speaking, when you have a BioBlitz, we like to have a few square miles and a few hundred people searching through them.
Now, is there any special equipment besides, you mentioned a magnifying glass, is there any other kind of equipment you'd need?
Well, if you're interested in looking for certain kind of things, most people are, they don't want to just go out and sort of look for everything that moves. Even just families who want to be part of it will join in and say, well, we just love butterflies, and we think we want to just see how many different kinds of butterflies we can get. And they ought to be able to get a butterfly net to do that. If they want to see all the different kinds of birds they can find, it would be binoculars. And, of course, if you want to see how many different kinds of ants or how many different kinds of little spiders and so on that live in the soil, you bring along a trowel, but it doesn't take much more than that.
All right, so when did you start doing the BioBlitzes?
Dr. Biology, we started it 10 years ago, 1998, and this is the 10th anniversary of doing that. I might add that it's so popular. I don't know the number of states around this country, but a large number of them have BioBlitzes. And one year, Massachusetts had BioBlitzes in every school district in the state. And then when you go abroad, you find the number of countries having BioBlitzes is now up to about 19.
You also are a champion of a project called the Encyclopedia of Life, which is a web-based project. Can you talk just a little bit about the Encyclopedia of Life?
Yeah. First of all, I invented the idea 5 years ago, and I suggested that we have an Encyclopedia of Life. It's on the web. The web address, incidentally, is eol.org, and I recommend it to anybody, eol.org. And we have a lovely introduction to the whole project. It is an electronic encyclopedia which is being built up now by a lot of scientists. It will have, does have already for many species, information on every kind of plant and animal, including right down to bacteria, known in the world, and everything known about each one in turn, with new information constantly being added, and information that's found to be wrong taken out, and going on indefinitely, and available to every person, everywhere, anytime, free.
Wow, 24/7 encyclopedia of life. But, you know, when you talk about the encyclopedia of life, there's a lot of discussion about how many species we already know about. I see the number about 1.7 million species. And some say that might be only 10% of the species on this earth. How are we going to make this really happen? I mean, how are we going to get everybody involved in your encyclopedia of life? And can we participate if we're not a scientist?
Well, you certainly can participate. And the figure, you're right, is somewhere a little under 2 million. I say 1.8 is a good figure. But it's true that probably only roughly, this is my guess, 10% of all of the different kinds of plants and animals and bacteria or fewer are known to science. In other words, 90% out there are still undiscovered by science. It's no big deal to find a new species. Well, that means that we're on a little-known planet. We need to explore this planet as though we're landing on Mars and then get a way of understanding all of that life, because our life depends on knowing it. And that's why I and a number of other scientists are really anxious to get people interested and get them involved, because just, you know, people who haven't been trained at science even can add to this. And certainly we need the support of everybody in promoting the idea of the Encyclopedia of Life and other scientific endeavors that help us explore this little-known planet.
I'm very hooked on the website myself. And I'm encouraging anybody who has not been there to go look at it, because it's right now in its infancy, even though it was conceived 5 years ago. We've got a lot of work to do. And I think we're going to need a big army. And so let's see if we can get people out there to do it. I had the pleasure of having Bert Hurdobler as a guest on Ask a Biologist. He is one of the preeminent ant specialist, myrmecologist, and you're co-author on several books, which brings us to writing. And we talk about science and scientists. You can't do science without communicating. So one of the things I like to talk about is the craft of writing. So how important has writing been to your science?
It's very important. Throughout my life, I've worked as a scientist. But let me tell you that when you get to writing up your results, especially if you want to make a lot of people aware of what you've found or what other scientists have found, which is so important in modern times, then the better you can write, the more effective you'll be as a scientist.
What's your favorite part of writing?
Well, I'm going to surprise you. All my life, I've written what's called nonfiction. That is, you know, I don't make anything up. Everything is fact. So writing about fact is an art in itself, to make it clear, to make it organized, to get it right.
Make it interesting.
And to make it interesting. But most recently, since you asked me my favorite kind of writing, I decided I'd try to do a novel. Well, I know a lot of people try to do novels, but I said to myself and my editor at the publishing house I use, I said, I think that if I use biodiversity and the search to save it and the fight to save it and show how a young boy, in this case in the South, grew up determined to be part of the effort to study it and save it, this would be a book a lot of people would like to read. Also, it would help bring attention, just a novel like that, to what the whole subject is all about. And so I've started writing it, and I've discovered I really enjoy writing fiction, you know, a novel. as anyone who undertakes it will discover. On the one side, it's just a tremendous amount of fun to create your own world in your own head. Your own people say the things you want them to say. But on the other hand, I'll tell you, it's real hard work. I was surprised at how hard it is to write a novel. You know, you really have to do a lot of thinking and a lot of imagining and select your words just right to describe people and how they live and what they look like and what they're trying to do and even what they think. So that's what I'm finding right now, I think, in overall, that I'm having the most fun writing a novel.
So is there a part of writing that you don't enjoy?
I don't think so, because the other writing I do, oh, wait a minute, let me take that back. The kind of writing I do not enjoy doing is possibly to a department store when I write and I say, are you sure I haven't paid that bill? No, most kinds of writing I enjoy doing, creative writing, both nonfiction and fiction.
You set your novel in the South, or at least your character is a young boy in the South. Turns out you were a young boy in mm-hmm. the South, and it sounds like to me you're doing one of the best things you can do when you start to be creative is to write what you know.
That's exactly right, yeah. People have said that the best novels, the ones people most enjoy writing and also most enjoy reading, are autobiographical. They're about the life of the author. But since they're fiction, and since you want to make them maybe more exciting than most of the life you actually led, then you are obligated to change things around. However, people you know, incidents that occurred, settings that you lived in, are valid background. You just don't try to present them literally, because this is fiction after all, and you need to combine them and break them up and add to them in ways that give the maximum amount of fun and drama in the work that you publish.
Right, and if you're writing a novel, now you're dealing with dialogue.
And you're dealing with dialogue. That's both tough and easy. For some people, they just can't get it down on paper the way they talk. But others, and I found it fairly easy myself, can write just the way people talk. You've got to be willing to, you know, write some poor English once in a while and sound a little dumb once in a while. But I find that it's very easy to sound very dumb, at least for me.
All right. I hate to do this, but we're going to have to switch back to your fiction, because you and Bert Herdobler have written a new book. It's called Superorganism. Can you talk to us a little bit about this book?
Yes, certainly. This is a big book, and it's nonfiction. It's real science. It has over 1,000 footnotes and thousands of references, you know, from the literature and so on. And it's very complete, but it's all about social insects, ants, a little bit of termites, some wasps, some bees. And why we call this superorganism and why that's important in biology and in life generally is that a colony of ants or honeybees, to take examples, are made up of a lot of little members, you know, many ants in a colony, an ant colony, and many bees, 50,000 maybe in a hive of bees. But they're so well organized, and they so depend on each other, and they're so altruistic, that is self-sacrificing and taking care of one another, that they've been able to build up very complicated and highly organized society, more than ones humans have. And so the result of that is that a colony of ants or a hive of bees almost acts like a single unit, you know, the whole colony. All of the 10,000 harvester ants or all the 50,000 bees act in almost in unison. So it's like one great big organism. It's a super organism, and that's where that title came from.
Is this going to be a book that the average person is going to pick up off the shelf and want to read?
Well, yes. It's beautifully illustrated. That's why I say that, because without being immodest, because it's mostly the work of my co-author, Bert Holdover, who is really creative as a photographer and in rendering art and so on, showing exactly how these creatures look and how they live. It's not as easygoing as many books written for a broad audience, but it is very readable, and especially when it's connected up with the illustrations that we have. You can figure out what the ants, mostly ants, but also bees, really are like, how they live, and why we call them superorganisms.
Well, you've helped me move right along into my next question. I brought in the studio another one of your books, talking about Phidolae in the New World. Now, Phidolae is the genus of ant that you have a particular passion, I'd say, right?
Yes.
And this book, we can talk about the science and your passion, but I also want to make sure we talk about not only the writing that's in here, but your illustrations. You illustrated the entire book. And from what I know, I think there's well over 600 species of ants in here. So how many illustrations do you have?
624 different kinds of ants in that one genus. 344 were new to science. I discovered them. And to illustrate all of them, all the 624, over 5,000 drawings that I did myself.
5,000 drawings?
Yeah.
How long did it take?
Well, off and on, 18 years. But, you know, when you do a scientific project like this, you're not sitting and doing it all the time. In fact, I did this one just at leisure, or sometime a Saturday afternoon, or early Sunday morning before the paper arrived, or a weekend when I just wanted to do something relaxing, like do a lot of drawings. And gradually, it came into existence.
So it's something that you consider relaxing for you. And the process, because we are drawing ants, I've seen a picture of you in front of a microscope. So are you using a microscope and then drawing the ants?
That's right, and listening to soft rock.
And listening to soft rock. Okay, well that brings up yet another question I'll ask later. I like to hear that.
Yeah.
All right, well, the illustrations are, they're simple, they're clean, but I know the word that I love the most about them, I consider them elegant. Why are they drawn this way? Is it purely for art purposes, or is there a science behind this?
Mostly science, but a bit of art. I design the whole layout so that each one of the 624 species, by the way, these 624 species make up about 20% of all of the known ant species of the Western Hemisphere. And so I, in order to make it possible to identify them and look at their traits neatly, I arranged all of the figures in the same way. Each species has, say, 10 or so drawings, or a little less than that in many cases, but they're all drawn exactly the same way so that you can compare species by species. But then what I did was to take them exactly as they look, in different poses, different directions, different parts of their bodies. And I drew them with very simple lines, and I drew in the traits, the exact shape of the head, the length of little spines on their bodies that they have, the sculpturing, as we call it, you know, the little dots they have on the outside of their bodies and lines that run through part of the body. I did those in a minimal manner that is accurate, but in a way that just highlighted what they really look like and why they're so different one from another. So basically, I suppose it does approach art in that it requires the interpretation of the form and how it's placed and how it's depicted. But it's not imaginary. This is the exact way the ants look.
The thing I find interesting is in this day and age when you can snap a picture in a second, you're still doing drawings. And after going through the book, I can tell why. And let me give my interpretation. If I look at a photograph, I get so much information that I'm often going to miss the subtle details or differences between different ants. And with these drawings, I think I can see them almost instantaneously.
I think you've got it exactly right. What the artist does, or in this case, the scientist in using art, is to depict exactly what makes that ant a different species. We see that used in caricatures, you know, in cartoons of people and so on. And the art there is to show those traits that make the person in that cartoon immediately recognizable. Well, I do that here, too, except that everything is accurate. It's not a distortion, not an exaggeration. It's exactly as the ant looks.
So this brings us to the world of the taxonomists, the ones that are actually looking at these different parts of the insects or plants or whatever animal you might be dealing with, being able to isolate those differences. Is there a particular species of Phidolae that you enjoy drawing more than another?
I enjoy drawing them all. And the reason is that in most cases, you know, when I was drawing something that was being seen for the first time. Very gratifying to be drawing something that no one has ever seen, and it's a new species, and you're introducing it to science. You're giving it a name that will be there for all time. But I guess if I had to pick one out that I thought was the most fun, it's the mustache ant. And I had the one specimen collected in Mexico. It's a soldier ant for that particular cast. It's a great big head, and it has bristles that stick out on either side from where its jaws are. And it makes it look like it has a mustache. And I enjoyed really depicting that. Of course, I did it exactly as it looks. But when it came out, it was such a strange-looking ant. So I called it, this is the full name, it's Phidolae. That's the genus name that they all have. But then I added the name Mystax, which means mustache. So there's the mustache ant.
Right, that's the Latin for it, right?
That's Latin, yeah.
Okay. Is there a part of drawing that you don't like or maybe you get frustrated with?
I think probably just the more routine parts of the body. You have to get them right. But it's when you get to the distinctive parts of the body that make that creature that you're drawing absolutely unique and makes it stand out from all else. Just as a portrait artist doing a human face arrives at those features that allow at a glance the identification of that person, that's when it gets really interesting.
Is there anything that you draw other than ants?
Actually, no. I have to admit, you caught me on that one. That's why I say I'm not an artist. I put my creative work in writing. That's where I do my best and most enjoyable work. I do say I so much enjoyed doing those thousands of drawings of these ants on this one occasion.
Well, maybe if it's okay with you, we'll have to check and see if we could do a short article on you that includes just a couple of these plates, maybe even the mustache ant, on the Ask a Biologist website, because I really would like people to see these things.
Sure.
And explain just a little bit more about them, because they really are just exquisite drawings. We're continuing our conversation with Ed Wilson. And since I introduced you as a science rock star in the last show, I thought I would ask you, what do you think it takes to be a really great scientist?
Let me put it this way. It isn't brains. It isn't intelligence. That may come as a shock to hear that. When I was a boy, I scored 123 in IQ. And that sort of depressed me because, you know, I wanted to be a scientist. And I thought, well, maybe I would be better as, I don't know, doing something else, just going into farming or whatever. But I stuck with science because I couldn't think of doing anything else. I subsequently learned that two of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, one is regarded as one of the two or three best theoretical physicists in the world, and another one of the great pioneering molecular geneticists, have IQs of 121 and 122. What's going on here? We always thought, you know, that the great scientists would have to be 160, 170, you know, and you've got, if you find a child that's got 160 IQ, then you direct them toward maybe science. But that turns out not to be the case. Where have all the 160s and 170s gone? And I'll tell you, they joined the Mensa Society and work for the IRS. I've decided that there is an ideal IQ for a scientist, okay? That's basically remembering words, putting words together, working out puzzles, doing crossword puzzles, which I'm lousy, and so on. There is an ideal intelligence, and that is bright enough to see what needs to be done, you know, to select the important problem in science, but not so bright you get bored doing it. Hmm. And I've often thought that when you get somebody that can put things together and do things real fast, they get A's without much effort, they get bored with ordinary puzzles and the like, then they get bored with science, because 90% or more of science is just plain hard work. Repeating, testing, going through routine possibilities one after the other into unknown territory for which there is no answer, not at first.
It sounds like an important part of being a good scientist is to be possessed or to have a passion for science.
Passion is absolutely essential. You have to have a passion for the subject. You really want to cast your imagination into the far galaxies. You just gotta know if there are Earth-like planets going around other stars and whether life will be there. You just have to know what the life was like on the bottom of the sea, or you just want to know everything about those orb-weaving spiders in your garden. Passion, you care, and you just stick with it. And people may even think you're a little eccentric, but there's much more.
So what do you think we should be looking for in ourselves or students that would make them successful in science?
A really good scientist is an entrepreneur. He or she wants to create something new. She wants to make her own little abode, practice the way of doing things, way of thinking about things. That's what good entrepreneurship consists of. The important lesson here in education is don't depend on ordinary intelligence tests. Don't depend on consistent good grades. Look for the passion in the student. Lay out an array, if you can do it in schools, the way the Boy Scouts do, for example. If we had a way of laying out subjects, a whole array of subjects, in addition to the ones that are required, it always has to be the fundamentals that are required and in which the student needs to memorize and practice. That's language, English, arithmetic, elementary, math, statistics. You just have to learn it, and the student cannot be allowed to escape. But that should only take a fraction of the time of even a person with an average amount of intelligence. But then you lay out a whole series of other subjects. They can be various forms of music, instrumentation, music appreciation, criticism, history. It can be different aspects of science that are, you know, near the entrance places for the actual disciplines themselves. It can be marketing. It can be visual arts. And let the student travel along and look over the possibilities. And I think you'll find if we did that, even as early as 9 or 10 years of age, that a student who has the potential to do extremely well, and most students do have the potential to do something extremely well, they will tend to settle on it, and then you give them free play and encouragement along with, you know, the other requirements. That would be my prescription for education. Maybe this has been thought about and tried and discarded, but somehow I feel it hasn't been. And it hasn't been for the reason that you asked that question. We really haven't come to understand what makes a human being want to do something on their own and do it well.
On this show, I ask three questions of all my guests. And it turns out that a lot of people enjoy listening to these answers. If you weren't a biologist, what would you be?
I believe that I would want to be an underwater explorer, one who, from a ship, explores the depths of the sea and maps it, or who dived to look at coral reefs and shipwrecks and under other hidden objects in the sea.
Do you recall when you first knew you were going to be a scientist?
Yes. I was 9 years old, looking through copies of the National Geographic, going out on little trips away from my home to nearby vacant lots and little wooded places and catching insects and then dreaming of someday studying them.
Now, when you were 13, you were the first person to discover the fire ants in Alabama. And I don't know if people realize that fire ants weren't native to the United States. They're what they're called an invasive species. Were you able to publish that work at 13?
No, not at 13, at 19. But when I was a 13-year-old boy, I was living in Mobile, Alabama. Our family was only 5 blocks from the shipping docks. We know that a number of insect species have come up from South America, hidden in the cargo over the years. And in 1942, I was just a 13-year-old boy. I was doing a Boy Scout project. I was seeing all the different kinds of ants in the neighborhood were. And it was then that I found one of these strange mounds, the fire ants, the introduced one, and it had come up on a boat for certainty. That is, that species, that kind of ant, in shipping from Uruguay in South America. And I made a note of it, and it was a spectacular nest of ants. By 1949, when I was a student in college, University of Alabama, that ant had begun to spread out and become a serious pest. I mean, that kind of ant. Even when I found that nest, probably there were many other nests in Mobile, although I was the first to see that kind of ant. I just happened to be in the right spot. So when I was 19 years old, I got my first job as an entomologist, and the state of Alabama put me to work trying to find out all I could about this new pest.
Tell me, since I introduced you as a rock star of science, and you actually mentioned you like soft rock, do you have a favorite rock star yourself? Or musician?
That's a tough question because I rarely paid attention to the individual singers. I had individual songs, melodies, background music I enjoyed watching. Mostly what I did was to focus while I was doing the microscope work on the soft, easy music of soft rock during that period. It's just an incidental, but it really helped provide a sense of peace and concentration while I was doing detailed work in sorting out all these 600-plus species.
Well, I find it interesting that it's soft rock that was bringing this peace and calm to you rather than, say, classical music or something like that, which you might stereotypically pick for a scientist. Okay, so you can't remember the names of your favorite rock star or musician. That's okay. Do you have a favorite rock star scientist?
I don't know any other rock star scientists. I know rock star science writers, but not rock star scientists.
Okay, who's a rock star science writer?
Well, those would include people like Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins, and before them, Carl Sagan. They weren't scientists in the sense that they were working in making scientific discoveries and doing research seriously. They didn't engage themselves with that. But they were writing about science for a broad public. And they were writing about real science. They didn't make it up. It wasn't science fiction.
Now, do you have any advice for a young scientist or someone who would like to become a scientist?
Yes. Find out what you'd really like to do in life, what you would like to look at, place you would like to visit, things you would like to see, and then see if you can go into science from that point of departure. In other words, maybe you like to take hikes in the woods with the scouts or with your parents or even alone. And during that time, you like to watch for animals. Most do when they're out hiking like that. Maybe searching for animals and looking at all the plants around them in the forest and seeing what they're doing is going to point you to a life as an ecologist or as an expert on rabbits or as someone that's really beginning to understand how many different kinds of mosses are and how the mosses help make up the ecosystem. Those are just examples that come from my head. Maybe you like music. And most of the time that means if you made a job of it, you'd be a musician, of course, or a composer. But on the other hand, who knows? Maybe your love of music will lead you, as one of my students who got his doctoral degree with me, you know, with my help, it'll lead you to studying how music works inside the brain. And this student, his name is Ani Patel, he's got a position in California now, has made wonderful discoveries to figure out what's happening in the brain when people listen to music.
Oh, so what's happening in your brain when you're drawing your ants and listening to the music, right?
I'm looking at the ants and I'm dreaming of where that ant lives and which one that looks the most like and what on earth it could do in life. And I'm saying, I'm going to go there. This one I've got to see in life. This one I've got to study. Why does it have that strange-looking spine on its back? What's it doing with that? Why is the head so long instead of round like most of them? And I'm thinking those things. And then I realize that if I followed up any one of them, I'd be doing real science, and that I probably, in time, would make some important discoveries.
Have you done a lot of traveling?
I've done a lot of traveling, yes, that's right. When I was young, I traveled around the world. My dream, while I was a boy, searching around through the swamps of Alabama and North Florida, my dream was to go to the big tropics. I mean, not just local forest, but to go to the Amazon, to go to the South Pacific, into the big jungles, and do real exploring way upriver, seeing things that nobody had ever seen before. And at the first opportunity was I was in my early 20s, and I had enough money to do it. I got fellowships from a university. Off I went to Cuba, and then on to Mexico, and then on to the South Pacific. And I got to go into real jungle, especially on the great island of New Guinea. So I found myself realizing a boyhood dream, that is, trekking across a mountain range into the center of a mountain range that nobody except local people had ever climbed before, seeing places that no one had ever seen before, finding new species of ants and frogs and taking photographs of places where nobody had ever set foot before. And it was a dream realized. And I wish every person could have that dream like that and then find the way to see it realized.
Of all the plants and animals that are on the earth, you picked ants. Why?
I just got fascinated with them when I was a boy, 9 or 10 years old. And There were good articles on ants. There was one in the National Geographic, and I had read a few other books, and I had mentioned ants in them, and they were so abundant. So when I went out on my little expeditions in Alabama and Florida and the woods there, and I knew I could always find ants, and there would always be different kinds. And by the time I got to college, I was 17 years old, I started. It was just very natural then that I would take a research project with a professor there and start doing serious ant studies.
If you don't mind, I'd like to give you one more two-minute drill.
Okay.
In 2009, it's going to be the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin, as well as the 150th anniversary of his famous publication on the Origin of Species. This is the first such book that applied a scientific approach to explain how we have such a large number of different kinds of plants and animals and how they changed or evolved over time. Can you explain why Charles Darwin was so important to the theory of evolution?
He invented the theory of evolution that turned out to be correct. There had been a couple of them before then. People had believed in evolution and they saw evidence of it. But it was Charles Darwin that really figured out how it works. And very simply, that is, it's so simple that you easily understand it in 30 seconds. You get, in every kind of plant and animal, you get a lot of variation. That variation comes from mutations that are inherited. Some mutations survive better, and the animals that have, or plants that have them, reproduce themselves better. And those are the ones then that become more abundant in a given population. And therefore, evolution is occurring.
You know, I only wish we had more time to talk because there are so many things that I'm sure people would like to ask you. And is there ever a chance we might get you to come to ASU?
Maybe, although right now I'm, I guess, partly because of the Darwin event. And I'm also in the middle of the novel and then moving on to a major work on social evolution I'm planning. And I get so many invitations now that I have to be very careful. Also, I'll be 80 in next June.
A very young 80.
Well, I feel very young. But I know that when you get to 80, something can go pop. And you know, I just never know. That's why I'm working at a furious rate, doing what writing I want to get completed now, because I never know when something will happen to bring it to a halt. I know that sounds a little fatalistic and grim, but that's the way I look at it, and therefore I'm trying to cut back on my travel.
So maybe I'll be able to come visit you someday.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea to me. We could manage that easily, I think.
Professor Ed Wilson, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Dr. Biology, it's been a pleasure.
Now, before I sign off, and in case someone missed the web address in the first part of this interview, the Encyclopedia of Life, which is a wonderful program that you have to check out, the web address is real easy, eol.org. And if you want to learn more about the really cool activity called the BioBlitz, you can type in BioBlitz into your favorite web search tool. And I think you'll find the results will pull up a whole bunch of information about these 24-hour living treasure hunts, how to participate and or create your own BioBlitz. And if you do have a BioBlitz and you want to let us know how it went, send your information to Ask a Biologist. We'd love to hear about what you're finding. The Ask a Biologist podcast is produced on the campus of Arizona State University and is recorded in the Grassroots Studio housed in the School of Life Sciences, which is an academic unit of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And remember, even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu, or you can just Google the words Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.